Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, and we're coming at you from the center of the universe, and that of course is Clear Creek County, Colorado. And this is The Rabbit Hole, and the special feature on The Rabbit Hole is Writer's Talk. And in the studio with me right now is Jody Bowersock. So Jody, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. And you have a little bit of a trip coming up the hill?
Yes.
You live where? Colorado Springs?
Colorado Springs.
I don't live here, but Idaho Springs. So it's true over that.
Yeah.
So it was a good drive, I take it.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
All right. Great day. Jody tells me she's never liked being put in a box. Over the course of her life, she has been an actress, a seamstress, designer, business owner, homeschool teacher, kids choir director, and artist. So it's only natural that her writing should take on an eclectic flair as well. Her romance novels span genres from faith fiction and suspense to time travel and sci-fi with the small town and big city settings. In addition, she has children's picture books to her credit, a book of stage productions, and a nonfiction Bible commentary. As an award-winning watercolor artist, Jody specializes in pet portraits. And as a seamstress, she creates women's vests out of men's ties. I find that very interesting. We need to talk about that briefly. You can view all of her creative endeavors as well as examples of her books at www, and that's jodybowersocks.com. And Jody lives in the heart, as we said, of Colorado Springs with her husband and too many cats, where they never get tired of looking at the mountain views. Mm-hmm. So welcome again, Jody.
Thank you.
All right. That's quite a resume. You have quite a background and a very eclectic one. So without getting too much into those particular, but I'm curious, have those helped you, influenced you in your writing? And if so, what ways?
Yeah, I would say it's probably all in there somewhere and probably pieces I haven't even used yet. But for instance, my very first novel is entitled Interiors by Design, and it's an interior designer. So everything that I learned as far as working as an interior designer went into that book and created that character.
Okay. So, these are, energies that might come up from the various ones. And, for example, you write children's books and you also homeschool children. So yes. Is there like behaviors that come into play? You kind of watch the kids and,
Well, the first book is A Tale of Two Kitties. And so it is basically a fictional story about two real cats that we had. And so just their kind of the dynamics of cats are there, even though it's a fictionalized story. But, cats who get into trouble and tear down a Christmas tree and, that's what cats do. Yes, we have a lot of background
with
cats.
I think children are that way, too. Kids,
yes.
Some of them could be.
Yeah, so, and it was a story that I told my kids when they were little and wrote it for them, and then it sat around for quite a while before I actually did something with it, but, and then the second book is I Do Not Know Where It Came From. It just rolled out one evening, The Stubborn Princess. I had two boys, I do not have girls, so I don't know where that one came from exactly, but I did do a little babysitting when I was younger, so I guess maybe it came from observations in that, but little girls don't often like their hair messed with, don't like it combed when it needs to be combed, etc. So that's kind of the theme of The Stubborn Princess is hair care, and she decides no, she's not going to, and what happens from that decision.
Yeah, so, well, you can see that in different children, and we are all this way. And we all have different personalities, and you say someone is more stubborn, or I am insisting it's going to be my way. And I'm curious about characters. You brought that up, and you say, okay, my two children are boys. Mm-hmm. And yet here you are writing a story for girls, and very strongly so. Now, having been a girl, you have that experience and watching kids. But these characters, do they just sort of come up out of somewhere, or do you think these through? How do they come about?
I am really what they call a pantser as far as plotting goes. I don't really plot. I have a general direction, and characters kind of grow out of little sparks and just take on their own life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm often very surprised at how they turn out. Mm-hmm. I have novels where, you know, I threw somebody in for a little comic relief that really kind of took over their, you know, they became a major character by the end of the book. And then one of them got her own book, basically, you know, the next one. So it was a surprise to me how that turned out.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, sometimes you'll get an idea for just the plot, the story, that then you think, okay, can that character shift just a little bit to make that work? So,
I'm curious then about not only your writing, but then the related, you said you were did some acting as well.
Yeah.
And what was that like? Were, you know, like impromptu, that sort of stuff there? And then, because actors, you have a script you're supposed to follow, but you're also encouraged, right, I guess, to be spontaneous and ad-lib, right, and do whatever. So.
Right. Yeah, I did. I'm a theater major. That's what I went to school for. Okay. So did some stage work, and so much fun. I mean, if I wasn't writing, that's what I would love to do. There's so much fun in doing that. But you kind of have to go to a bigger city to really, you know, pursue that as a career, which I never really wanted to do. So, but yeah, the you bring your own flair, I guess, to whatever character you're doing. And I think that maybe that putting myself into various characters has perhaps helped in writing other characters and mm-hmm. Being able to flesh them out so that they're a rounded character that makes sense and is consistent and all of that.
And so, that you have that strong background. You say your degree is in theater, and it's all about character, but also storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So creating stories, and where do these come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I sense that in your writing then, it something spontaneous, mm-hmm. if you will,
right.
that what I'm hearing. And as you talked about being a pantser, and mm-hmm. I know all about that. You mm-hmm. just start writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume you don't know what the ending is when you start writing, and it is where it is when you're done. Is that
I mean,
right?
You have kind of a direction that you know you're going. Since I write mostly romance, that requires a happy ever after. You know, it just has to have a happy ending if you're writing in the strict romance category. And you know, who's going to end up together.
Yeah.
How they're going to get there is the whole story, basically. And, you know, what happens along the way. And I don't like to write, you know, just the shallow romance stories. They've got to have another story in there. It's got to be, you know, a suspense going on, some sort of, you know, for instance, Cinnamon Girl Explains It All has a serial killer and a detective and, you know, all these other stories that wrap around your little romance that's in there. So
when you're writing a story and you're telling the story through your writing, what it seemed there are two critical elements to a story. Well, several. Mm-hmm. Setting, of course, mm-hmm. is huge right there. But the plot itself, what is the arc of the story, but mm-hmm. the characters.
Mm-hmm.
In your stories, are they more, do you sense, or is it a variety, that they're more character-driven, more plot, you know, here, or is it kind of like balance? I don't know.
I think you have to have a good balance, because if you've got great characters and no story, that doesn't go very far.
Yeah.
And if you've got a story with shallow characters, that's kind of dull too. So I think it is a pretty good balance. But I do really, I think I spend a lot of time fleshing out the characters.
Okay.
So that they are more than just stock, you know, I make fun a lot of Disney villains. You know, that's what I call them. It's the villains that are so evil. you know, that there's just nothing else to them. And so even if I have bad guys in my story, I want them to be real people. I want them to have motivation. I want them to want you to be able to see that, yeah, they are probably not just an evil person. They've got other elements to them also.
That's interesting. Yeah. So when you have it, and I would assume, is that true in not only your, say, romance novels and sci-fi that are might perhaps be more adult or young adult, mm-hmm. and then you have the children's story, if you have like an ogre in there, even the ogre in the children's story, there's a empathetic side to him or her or something?
I don't know that I've ever... Well, actually, there are some characters in my Stubborn Princess that you think at first are going to be kind of nasty characters, and then they actually turn out not to be. But I haven't written a children's story that has the, you know, like any real bad guys or ogres or anything in it. But I would think if you did, that might be really interesting to show that, you know.
Maybe that's your next children.
Yeah, maybe.
Think about that,
yeah.
You know, that how we can identify, because we're human and we all have flaws. We're all imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have a character who's just perfect all the way through, it's tough for the reader to identify with him or her.
Right.
So to have, there's like this other side, okay, she's doing a lot of bad stuff, but boy, when you look at his or her background and understand, you know, the family life or whatever it is, then you can be more empathetic, I would think.
Right. And you have it helps you have a story. I mean, perfect people don't really have a story to tell, you know, because we want conflict. That's kind of the conflict and the resolution that drives the story along. So.
Yeah, and then to have that redemptive quality also that if someone is so bad, and yet... somehow they end up as the, like, in the story, and especially, you know, the anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
That, in my classic example, when I taught English, was Gatsby. And how Gatsby was not a good, noble man.
Right.
But you identified with him, and you cheered for him all the way through, and you felt bad at the end.
Right.
For him, and you know, and that's the beauty of, you know, great writing. In this case, here, one of the greatest, F. Scott Fitzgerald, telling that story.
Right.
Yeah. So, what then? You know, we're talking about, but what motivated you then to start writing in the first place?
Well, I've kind of been a writer my whole life. I remember a little children's story I wrote and illustrated called An Old But Famous Rug, and it was George Washington's rug, and it was told from the viewpoint of the rug. Okay,
always being stepped on.
Yeah, getting washed and all of that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so early on I enjoyed telling a story. And then I got a lot of accolades, I guess, for being the 4-H news reporter. And I was elected over and over for that position because nobody else wanted to do it. And I did it pretty well. So that was kind of a start where people started saying, hey, she's good at that. And I can't say I did a whole lot of creative writing through school. I wrote some terrible poetry. Awful stuff.
Almost all poetry
is
terrible.
Yeah, some really bad poetry. But then I started, let's see. When I was a senior in college, I wrote a play that I did for my senior project and directed it and everything. And then after that, I ended up writing a lot of skits for my church, a lot of children's programs for my church and homeschool group. And so that I have actually compiled into one book now that I did. I compiled it last year. So it's like 20 years of writing for the stage, skits and programs and stuff like that. And then my mother was this really huge romance reader. You know, she just devoured them. And I tended to be more on the sci-fi fantasy side of things. But she kept telling me, you could write better books than these. I just know it, you know. And I'm like, well, Mom, maybe someday I'll have the time to do that. I was homeschooling and everything. And so, and trying to fit in some directing stuff just for some creativity. So after my kids were done with school, I actually picked up, I can't say I picked up the pen, I pulled out my keyboard, I guess, and I gave it a shot. I had an idea, and I just went for it, and it became an instant obsession. Mm. I just fell in love with it. I cranked out that first book in probably 3 months. It was just, you know, so much of what was just me, I guess. And mm-hmm. I had this story idea and it just rolled out. The second one went just about as fast. That's my small town Nebraska book, Horses, Adrenaline, and Love. So that has everything I know about small town Nebraska plus everything I learned as a horse owner. Mm-hmm. Every malady my horse ever had is in that book. So, I just started going, and it just became an obsession. And I now, when I'm not writing, all I can do is think about what am I going to write next.
Oh, wow.
And I try to force myself in between books, this list of things I've put off in life. I have the list. It's like, okay, I've got to get this done before I can start writing again. And frankly, I usually don't finish the list right before I get back to writing. But yeah, it's just so much fun. And I do art too. Mm-hmm. And art for me is, I mean, I enjoy the finished product of a piece of art. All the way through it, I don't enjoy it as much as I enjoy the process of writing.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know. I think it's because it's so easy to make a change in writing. You know, you write a sentence, you don't like it, you delete it. In art, it's a little bit harder to get rid of something you don't like or what you make a mistake you made or, you know, it's just, it takes, I guess, and it's because art is a layered thing. And so it takes quite a while for you to feel like you're there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
But the story, you can see as you're going, you could read that whole first chapter to somebody, mm-hmm. and it's complete, maybe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the first layer of your artwork is just kind of junk. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different kind of journey, I guess, throughout. And I tend to enjoy the writing journey more than I enjoy the art journey. Although I do love the finished products of the artwork.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you talk about that, Jody, because they're both creative elements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they come from a central aspect of our psyche, the creativity. But what strikes me when you're describing that is that art is very visual. It's right in front of you.
Yes.
And it's immediate. So how mm-hmm. am I seeing this? Whereas in a story, and I'm a writer, you are, mm-hmm. you know, and written a lot more, but you have a, you know, you're telling the story, but it's like art when it's done, that once it's done and it's put out there, the reader, mm-hmm. you know, may not read it exactly, or they may pick up different elements of it, which mm-hmm. shows the complexity of the story there.
Right.
In that. So I'm just curious, you know, what part of, and maybe there's no answer, but, you know, we have listeners that might be, you know, have a mm-hmm. an art studio, and they also sit there and do creative writing also.
Mm-hmm.
And how do these products evolve, come about, and show, and come to fruition? I find it very fascinating.
Yeah. Now, the art that I do is mostly by commission. If people have a pet they want painted, that's okay. Basically what I do. Occasionally, I do my own pets just for fun if I've had a special one. Usually one that's passed away, then you're like, oh, you know, I got to do a painting of that one. But so generally, that's how I do my art. Mm-hmm. And then the writing has to come from kind of a different spark, you know, that has to come from a different place. The unfortunate thing about the difference between art and writing is that I can show somebody a piece of art that mm-hmm. I've, done in, that's taken me 5 days, 5 days to do. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's wonderful. I want it. And then the book that you've spent 4 to 6 months writing,
mm-hmm.
all you can do is show them the cover and read them the synopsis and then hope they're intrigued enough to dive in for that 8 or 9 hours of reading it's going to require to absorb that kind of thing. And so that's harder, and it's frustrating for me as someone who does both, because I know how much longer it takes to craft the book than it does to do the artwork. And yet that gets immediate accolades.
Right, because it's a visual. It's
right in front of you. Yeah, they either like it or they don't. Yeah.
You need to actually put the...
Right.
So there's a complexity to it. There's the immediacy of feedback. Art is right in front of you. And most of us will just look at it and make a judgment without sitting there studying it, which, if you go to the Louvre or whatever, you're looking at classic Picasso, whatever, and to really absorb what's in there. And then there's also the structure. Novels and writing are structured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the, the beginning, mm-hmm. the opening, you're creating the setting and everything, so you can follow along.
Right.
It's a more cerebral. Whereas mm-hmm. when we look at, complex art and, sometimes we're just like, okay, that confuses us because it is so right-brained. I'm talking about now the recipient, whether it's the reader or the observer of the art piece too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then how does the artist, whether it's a writer or a painter, absorb the feedback that she gets from that too? And
as a writer, we're waiting constantly for reviews. You know, you're waiting and waiting and waiting for a review. So few people actually write reviews. And sometimes they only write reviews when they didn't like it. So it's hard to get a real feel sometimes for the reception, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when we were talking one time, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but you were saying about in your writing in the novels about the ending. It's always a happy ending. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, yeah. When you write romance, it's that's what's expected.
You ever think about writing one where there's not a happy ending?
No, because I don't like books like that.
Because then it's antithetical to your psyche and everything too.
Yeah,
so good point.
Yeah, I really don't like movies that don't have happy endings either. I feel like that was a waste of my time. So, that's just me. I'd rather have a happy ending.
Yeah, but you probably don't want to watch Virginia Woolf, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, right?
Yeah, probably not.
but that type of thing there. So, but again, that reflects, your perspective. And people are that way too,
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious also, and I want to move on, but one other thought, when you talked about writing the romance novels and how your mm-hmm. mother had prompted you way back in the day. And she said, you can write better than what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think she meant by that?
Because she had read so many romances are formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you get tired of the formula. I get tired of the formulas just reading the synopses of various books. I joke with my husband about how someday I'm going to write the billionaire Navy SEAL who has a marriage of convenience you could go on and on. Oh, and his name is Mr. Darcy. It's crazy how those same things are just done over and over. I don't know how many billionaire romances there are out there. And come on. It's a big myth.
Mm-hmm.
The romantic billionaire romance is such a myth in our country. And but the formulas just get old.
Yeah.
And that's the my motto is real life, real love, because I do not like to write in formula. Yeah, it has to have a happy ending, but how you get there does not have to be a standard trope, you can do something new. You can do something different.
It seems to me that speaks to the complexity then of your writing compared to, and not judging anybody else's out
mm-hmm.
there, but you have a very high standard that the story needs to not just follow And you're over here.
Right.
And maybe there's readers out there who are very content with that, and they're just happy. Mm-hmm. You know, I linked a time, and that's fine.
Right.
But you have a higher or a different mm-hmm. perspective on that, it seems.
Right. That you can have a more complex story and more complex characters, and it does not have to follow the standard rules, I guess. I don't know if that's even a thing, but it seems like so many, for instance, romance novels, if you've got them going, they are getting along well, they've got to break up, you know, before the ending at some point. It's like, well, that doesn't have to happen every time. You can have some other reason for their existence, you know. It just... But that, you can just feel it coming in so many of them. And that bothers me. I want to do something different.
And how does that translate? Because you've written sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Does that hold true in sci-fi with your stories there? Or is that a little bit different?
Sci-fi is a little bit different. Sci-fi, and I have to admit, I haven't read a lot of the sci-fi romances that are out there. Some of them sound kind of bizarre, like the alien romances. No, there's a whole category called dark alien romances. I'm not sure I'm going there, you know, but, mm-hmm. And my sci-fis are really fun. They're more on the humorous sci-fi side. So it's kind of a unique combination. There are humorous sci-fis out there, but then adding in the romance is a whole nother element. So
so your sci-fi, one can almost categorize it as a an alternative romance novel in a way.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, right. You know, so. Yeah, it's a whole mm-hmm. different setting. So okay. You've taken romance, put it in a different setting, and see what it does to it. You know, basically, you've got different problems, different things you're dealing right. with, and just
yeah,
because
especially
of,
if you've got alien cultures and
right,
you know,
right,
people
which,
are
yeah.
beat me up, Scotty, sort of stuff. There, yeah, it's a whole different
right,
element to
right.
A story there. But we've been talking quite a bit about, especially the romance and the touch on the sci-fi. But you don't write just in that genre. There, you have nonfiction. And I'm not sure, remind me about the, what's the Lightning Riders?
Yes.
What is that about?
Okay, that's a time travel series.
Okay.
So, and it's set in the Manitou Springs, Colorado Springs area. So, I got to do a lot of research on those areas, which, you know, we're not native, or at least I'm not a native Coloradoan. We've lived in Colorado Springs about 6.5 years. So it was exciting to me to be able to do the research on a new place. And so it was fun. It deals with Pike's Peak and the history of the Cog Rail and the Antlers Hotel and all those different places that are landmarks. They're still there. I mean, Antlers has changed, but it's still there. Manitou Springs has a lot of places that have been there since the late 1800s. And so, you know, you can talk about Barker House. It's still there.
Yeah.
You know, so that's interesting how you can grab these names out and use them in your book from in 1892. And they're still there today. So that's kind of fun.
So when you're time traveling on these here, I'm taking it, then you're touching into actual Colorado history.
Yes, yeah.
And these were real places, and you ever yeah. pull on real characters from that time.
Only just kind of in passing as you're kind of setting your history. There's some mention of General Palmer, who's big in the, you know, Colorado Springs area and stuff like that, and Glen yeah. Erie and all of those places. Because it starts out with a gal who's come to Colorado Springs on vacation. She's seeing all the highlights, the touristy places. So, and it was inspired by a real trip up Pike's Peak that I took in a thunderstorm. So we're sitting on the cog rail at the top, and they won't let us off because the lightning's too bad.
Yeah.
And so it took us, you know, we sat for a while and then had a very shortened time at the top because of that. But that just got me to thinking, you know, there's that Living History Ranch really close to Pike's Peak. She's just been there. And it just, you know, the lightning, the time travel always has to have a convention of how does it happen.
Uh-huh.
Is it science? Is it fairy rings? Is it, you know, like Outlander has the big rocks in Scotland or wherever, England, where they go through. And there's always either a magic element, a sci-fi element, or it's a complete mystery.
Someone has to, has to be some motive.
Some reason. Something that takes you back. I even read one where they just looked at the moon at a certain time and they were transported. And that seemed a little weird to me because I think everybody would be zooming all over time with that conviction.
Yeah,
it's like, oh my gosh. Yeah, you just look at the moon. Okay. But so mine was the lightning. It was, she was sent back by a lightning strike. And you find out later on that there is more of a scientific reason for it. It's not just as weird as being struck by lightning. But at first, that's all they know. So that she went back by lightning. And so that was just that was my convention that I used to get her back there. But then, of course, time travel always has to have the juxtaposition of your time versus the time you went to and the differences and how do you fit in and, you know, all of that has to be a part of it to make that work. So,
and it seems that then this requires maybe, and correct me again, you know, writing a romance novel, you sit and you tell a story, a children's story, and you just draw on it. But stories like this, you mentioned, for example, the lightning.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scientific basis for that in some way. So you've had to do some incredible research, both historically and know your science or do some research on that to make it credible, it seems.
Yes. And the fun thing about if you have a sci-fi element is you could kind of pull some things, not completely out of the air, but you can just call it a future something that's going to happen, mm-hmm. and you can use it. You know, mm-hmm. it's not invented yet, but it's out there in the possible future. And so you can just, you can dream it up, basically.
Okay.
And use it.
Yeah. Kind of like the Matrix series or something
exactly.
of that nature, because we're still learning. And
right,
so
right.
you have free reign when you go into the future, whereas
right.
in the past, you have to stick to...
Exactly.
You can't
this is
get
what
in.
We've got. And that's where you have to okay. look up so much stuff. And it's the little things that are hard to find out.
Yes.
The price of how much did a photographer charge in 1892 to take a portrait? That sort of thing. That's hard to find.
But that's critical.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
And tell me why. Why is that so important?
Well, it wouldn't be if you wanted to ignore it completely, but if you wanted to point out how cheap it was, mm-hmm. then you've got to have it right. You know, if you were just, you know, they went to a photographer and ignore the whole cost issue. But if that's a point you want to make, then you have to find out.
If you're going to make that point, and another reason is that invariably someone's going to read that book who does know that
yes,
information.
Right.
And if you say it was $1.25 mm-hmm. and he says, no, it was 17 cents.
Right.
It seems like your all your research now is
yeah.
questioned.
Right. Yeah. It was extremely inexpensive from mm-hmm. what I did find out. And I kind of had to extrapolate from Britain prices at that time.
Oh.
And because I really couldn't find the answer I was looking for. So I could get close. But and even like, okay, what was invented? Jell-O? Was there Jell-O at that time? Was there, you know, yeah. if they're shopping in a grocery store, what can she actually buy? Because she's not used to any of this.
Right.
So the things that she's missing, she's looking for, and you have to know, is it there? Is it not? So.
Yeah. And that's, I think, you know, my listeners, when I talk to them and they comment or ask questions about authors such as yourself coming on, and about the amount of work it goes in, because the writing process, it takes, mm-hmm. you have to sit down in front of the keyboard. You simply have to do it, or mm-hmm. pen on paper, mm-hmm. however you do it,
yeah.
you're doing it old school. But when you're, particularly when you're writing in genres such as sci-fi mm-hmm. or historical fiction, in a way,
right.
because your novel could be, it seems, classified as even historical fiction, even though she's going
right,
back in
right,
that time.
Right, right,
because you're drawing on real events and real places and real facts then, too.
Right, yeah. And even with my Mars series, which is what I'm working on now, Mars Madness was the first one, and I'm working on Beware the Eyes of Mars. I had a plot line where there's the basic plot is it's so far in the future that there's a resort on Mars. So I have all these in the second one. There's a lot of tunnels that are discovered under my resort, which the criminals have kind of taken over. So I had to figure out kind of a reason for those tunnels' existence. Okay. And as I was, and I have to admit, I had the idea before I had the real foundation for it.
Yes.
But I did, in reading about Mars and what the first things that anyone who went to Mars would do, it was mining. So I was like, okay, there's my tunnels. They've already been there before they even built the resort. So,
and that makes total sense in today's culture, because there's all this talk now getting back to the moon. Why? Because it'll be a launching port, you know, to get to Mars, whether that happens in our lifetimes. But still, you know, that whole idea. And again, the mining and, you know, what minerals are there.
Right.
You know, and again, do your research, you know, they say, for example, you know, back they now demonstrated, you know, millions of years ago, Mars had a raging ocean.
Right.
Okay, now. Right. But they still say there's water underground.
Yeah.
Is it fit for human consumption sort of thing there? If it is, then can people be living there? I don't know.
Right,
you know? But that's not beyond the credibility, too, it seems.
Yeah.
So what was the name of this novel again?
The new one is Beware the Eyes of Mars.
Okay, and I like the way you play on that, too. The Eyes of March. Eyes of Mars. Yes. A little Shakespeare.
And Mars Madness was the first one, you know, off of March Madness that always happens.
You draw on the moon, too, by the way, with the madness, right? Yeah, and everything, too. But you have another workout, Tripping on Mars.
Well, that's the whole series.
Okay.
It's called the Tripping on Mars series.
Okay.
And that has a little play of, you know, you're taking a trip to Mars, and it's a little trippy once you get there. So
is this like a trilogy that you're
doing? It's going to be a trilogy, yeah.
Okay.
So book two is going to come out hopefully next month. And then the third one will be the Mars Air, H-E-I-R.
Oh, so, I like that. Yeah, again, you're playing on the word.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a little connotation there, and you have to pick up. I love that. Tell me, you had a co-author on one of those? Or?
Yes. Well, that's kind of funny. People ask me all the time, who is Rhonda Holloway? Because she's listed on the front of the book as a co-author with me. And she is actually a character out of my Rocky Mountain series who, she's an author. And these books, Mars Madness and Beware the Eyes of Mars, are listed as her books that she wrote. So I just thought, gee, wouldn't it be fun if I wrote her books? So it's kind of an inside joke for anybody who's read the Rocky Mountain series and knows that character.
Okay. Again, another complexity, a twist on it, too. And so, because you write under your real name.
Yes,
you don't have no diploma or anything of that nature. And this is how Rhonda comes in. That's pretty fascinating. And again, it's that element of creativity that comes in. And even your titles, you know, the Eyes of Mars, you know, right away I think the Eyes of Mars, because it sounds boom. And then the Mars Air.
Right.
Well, with, right away I think of, well, there's no air on Mars that we know of, or it's very light. But no, it's H-E-I-R.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it just sounds that. And so you play on that, you know, and draw on it. That's pretty fascinating. Man, this has been a fantastic discussion here. Now, I did want to, because you have your works not only in print, but also Audible. And do you have somebody do these for you? Or you've been an actress, so.
Right. So I do the Audible books myself, which can be frustrating at times. But, but yeah, I would rather do them myself than I know I'm getting the characters just right. And, you know, the inflections are right. I know the pronunciations are going to be right, etc. And since I can do it, you know, why pay somebody else to do it? So,
okay. Do you have a studio for this, or how do you do it? You go into your closet, make sure you got all your clothes hanging around, because that's important. You
don't I have echoes made. I have made around my desk. I took like a shower curtain, a specially bent shower curtain rod. Nice. That then has, I have got fleece around the wall, and then I can pull the other around me. So it creates just this little booth with fleece all around. And so that helps with the echoes. Yeah.
A sound studio.
Yeah.
And you don't have a dog to be barking while you're in the middle of it.
Cats don't. But yes, sometimes the cats claw on my door because I've shut them out. But
yeah. All those little things, because, you know, if you have a sensitive mic, you know, right, then it's going to pick up on
it. Oh, yeah, it does. And that's the frustrating part, is that you don't even realize sometimes you've made a thump or a boom or whatever. And and so you do it again. And
And I, you know, when I'm interviewing authors, sometimes, you know, you get animated, the author does, and they'll just hit the table, and it comes through, you know, and that's okay, that's all. But, you know, when you're doing an audible book, okay, you want it to be, perfect, you know, flawless as it possibly can be. So that's quite a feat on your part to do that.
A couple of nights ago, my cat leaped up as I was editing, hit his back feet on my keyboard as he went to the top, and all of a sudden, everything changed. And I'm still in discussions with Audacity of to how to get back to what... Yeah, I'm not sure. I may just have to re-edit it, but I was so close to done. It's frustrating on that chapter, but...
You see, now there's a story there.
Yeah.
You know, Rhonda and the cat.
Yeah.
All right. If people want to get a hold of you, they want to get a hold of your books, they want, you know, what's a good way to do all this, and what's available for them?
Well, all my books are available on Amazon. So just look up books by Jodi Bowersox, JodiBowersox, or my website is www.jodibowersox.com. If you want something autographed, that is the best way to get that to happen. They are available for Kindle, and if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, they are available there, and for Audible. So try to hit all of the possible ways people could read and listen, enjoy. So not all of my novels are on Audible yet, probably about half of them. But
as long as the cat doesn't keep jumping up, you might be able to make some progress.
Yes, and I've been working on a French accent for one of mine for a while. So.
All right. And then on your website, too, it's not just books.
Right. I do have my art gallery is there. If anybody's interested in pet portraits, that's there. Links to my Etsy store is where I sell my vests that are made of men's ties.
I find that intriguing.
So, that's all the links are there on my website for just about everything. So,
yeah, because I still have these ties that I never wear a tie. Almost never wear a tie anymore, but I got these great classic ties, the really fat ones from like the 70s.
Oh,
all the intricate patterns, and you're talking about modernistic art.
Yeah, those are perfect for it, because you try to have those that are, you know, I have to have at least one star tie for each vest that's got almost an art feel to it, and then you kind of fill in with your basic stuff. Yeah. But that, it's real fun. It really is art to do.
Okay. All right. So now I know to whom to leave my ties to in my will.
Exactly,
Or before, that you can do them. If I ever decide, I mean, I look at it, but I just love the patterns, and people go like, that is so retro. And I go, I know, I love it.
Yeah.
Because I'm old too, you know.
Right.
So what the heck.
Yeah.
All right. So one more time. Website?
www.jodibowersox.com.
All right. All right, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7. Been visiting here with writer, author, Jodi Bowersox, who's more than an author and a writer. She's an actress, a seamstress. She's, oh my gosh, you know, we don't have enough time to go back over everything she's able to do and does so well. And we'll be back in the future here, but we want to thank you for joining in. And everyone take care now. Bye.